There is a Mishnah in Maseches Tainis which records the different things that took place in Jewish history, in the early part of Jewish history, before the days of the Mishnah, on Tisha B'Av. One of the things the Mishnah mentions that it was then decreed that the Dor HaMidbar, the Jews who came out of Mitzrayim, that generation would not enter into Eretz Yisrael. That was a direct result of the rebellion of the Chet HaMeraglim. We know the story. As actually recounted in brief form in yesterday's Sedra and Parshas Devarim. Yesterday was Tisha B'Av. Actually, today we observe the fast. Yesterday was actually Tisha B'Av, as you know. And we always read Parshas Devarim that we learned yesterday on the Shabbos immediately prior to the observance of Tisha B'Av. That's the case every year without exception. And we mentioned in the Sedra a little bit about the Chet HaMeraglim. And the Gemara later on explains that it's not really clear from the Pesukim in the Torah how you figure out that it was on Tisha B'Av, because the Torah doesn't give a date as to when the Chet HaMeraglim happened. However, based upon other dates that the Torah does give, and we know that they were gone for 40 days and so on, so the Gemara has a whole calculation, and the Gemara figures out that indeed, the Meraglim came back, we'll assume for our purpose now, in the afternoon of the 8th of Av, and that night, when it says in the Chumash, Vayivkru'om Balailahu, that the whole nation cried and complained that night after the report to the Meraglim, that night was none other than the night of Tisha B'Av, at which time, and some of you heard this, I'm sure, over the weekend, whether my shul or here and the other shuls and so on, Kadosh Baruch Hu said to the Jewish people at that time, Atem b'chisem b'chia shalchinam, you cried on this night for no good reason, b'chia shalchinam, free, purposeless, needless crying. So therefore, I'm going to establish that this evening, the night of Tisha B'Av will be a night of crying for all time. An example that I gave is sometimes you say to a child, you say a child's whining or crutching, so you say to the child, if you don't stop crying in a minute, I'm going to give you something to cry about. And that's exactly what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to the Jewish people, basically. This determined that this night's going to be a night of crying for all time. Now, I mentioned in my show yesterday here that based upon the simple understanding of that presentation, there's nothing that thematically relates the Chet HaMeraglim to the destruction of Beis HaMikdash and to the Golos. You know, this was a tragedy. It took place on the same night. So Kodesh Baruch Hu said, well, this night they complained, and so now they're going to get a punishment years later, a double punishment two times, the Churban Bayis Rishon, the Churban Bayis Sheni, and so on, but not necessarily that there's a thematic connection. Well, I'd like to suggest that maybe there is a somewhat of a thematic connection. We were given by HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the years subsequent to Yetzias Mitzrayim, we were given the Torah, and we were given Eretz Yisrael, these two gifts. When it came to the Torah, the Bnei Yisrael responded, as we know, Naaseh V'Nishma. They accepted the Torah. They accepted the Torah right away. And perhaps it's for that reason that the Torah has always been part of our national identity. Yes, there were people who kept it more rigorously and more strenuously and more stringently than others. Some people didn't keep it at all. But in terms of our national identity, the Torah is part of our national identity. However, Eretz Yisrael, the other gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, that's not the case. Eretz Yisrael is not part of our national identity in a certain sense for the majority of Jewish history. We lived in Eretz Yisrael, starting in the time of Yehoshua, we conquered the land. We lived there for a long while. We had the first base of Mikdash, then we were exiled. We had the second base of Mikdash, but then we were exiled again. And just doing the math, we were outside of Eretz Yisrael for far, far, far longer than we were in Eretz Yisrael. And perhaps it's because when we initially were given Eretz Yisrael, we were hesitant about accepting it. They said to Moshe Rabbeinu, we learned yesterday, well, we'd like to send out scouts to see, is it good, is it not good, are we satisfied, are we not satisfied? And when they came back with a report that it's dangerous, well, we don't want to go, what'd you bring us here for? The Torah, they accepted right away. So the gift of the Torah we accepted, so it became immediately part of our national identity forever. Eretz Yisrael was perhaps not the case. And perhaps that's a thematic connection. It's not Stam that the Chet HaMeraglim took place on Tisha B'Av and the destruction of Beis HaMikdash took place on Tisha B'Av, but one was the result of the other in a certain sense. It's because we refused to accept the gift of Eretz Yisrael when it was originally given open-heartedly and refused to welcome it into our midst, that never became, in the same sense, a part of our national culture, our national psyche. Yes, we long to return to Eretz Yisrael, we daven to return to Eretz Yisrael, but somehow it seems to me, and one can debate this, but it seems to me that Eretz Yisrael was almost like somewhat removed from the Jewish people for the most of our existence as a nation. Now, that began to change a couple of times in history. The Ramban in the 1200s tried to encourage people to move to Eretz Yisrael. In the 1700s, there were different movements, 1700s, 1800s, I'm not going through all of that now, there were different movements of Jews to come back to Eretz Yisrael. Among the religious Jews, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, the great Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, came to Eretz Yisrael. Many of them came to Eretz Yisrael. In fact, many customs in terms of davening and other customs in Eretz Yisrael to this day are slightly different. I'm talking about among Ashkenazim now. Are slightly different than the Ashkenazic practice that we have here because they were established by the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. They followed his practice. Also, the Talmidim of the on the Chassidic side, the Talmidim of Baal Shem Tov, the Talmidim of the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, also came. So you had a beginning to have an influx of Jews. There were always Jews who came to Eretz Yisrael, who came, basically came to die there and to be buried there. But slowly there began to be more interest in, among Jews of coming to live there as well. And then, of course, in the 1800s, the Zionist movement and other similar such movements, so there began to be more interest in somehow Jews returning to Eretz Yisrael. Every group, naturally, among Jews, had their different goals and what their purposes were and so on, but things began to change in terms of the centrality of Eretz Yisrael in the Jewish mindset. Now, to understand the period that I'd like to look at today, the time that we have, the British so-called British Mandate period, and in doing the research, I realized really we have to split it into two. So another Tisha B'Av, another time I have to discuss the second half, because really there's a lot to discuss. And I think I'm just going to discuss really up until the Holocaust, up until, let's say, 1940, because, again, many things happened. Ultimately, the establishment of the state in 48, but up until that point is really what I want to look at. But in order to understand a little bit, we have to have some background information, because World War I, which broke out on Tisha B'Av in 1914, was a bit of a turning point, as we'll see. In 1914, when World War I started, so there was no division of countries or nations in the Middle East like you have today. There was no such thing as Jordan or Syria or Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Iraq. There were no such countries. What there was a big landmass, basically. And it was under the general rulership, was known as the Ottoman Empire, which is based in Turkey. The Ottoman Empire was founded way back in 1299. A gentleman by the name of Osman, who was some kind of a sheikh or whatever exactly he was, and he consolidated into an empire. Okay, it was a tribal. He was a tribal leader, and the Ottoman Empire grew in power, grew in military power. It was the Ottoman Empire that ultimately ended the famous Byzantine Empire. Okay, with their conquest of Constantinople in 1453, and the Ottoman Empire grew in power in the 16th and 17th century under the leadership of people like Suleiman the Magnificent. A nice title, right? Suleiman the Magnificent. I think there's a street in Yerushalayim in the Arab called the Rehov Suleiman. You know, it's an honorable person from the Turkish Arab background. And he basically, and some of his successors, put together a country or an empire really that extended well into Europe, Southeast Europe, parts of Central and Eastern Europe, Western Asia, North Africa, the Horn of Africa, you know, the part that juts out and so on to the west. And it became a huge empire based in Constantinople. And it was this empire, the link for about 500 years between Europe in the west and the Eastern world, whether it's the Orient and India and so on, for trade purposes and so on. And all of this was under the Ottoman Empire. However, the Ottoman Empire, for really at least 100 years or more, really, before 1914, was in decline. It was a huge area. There were issues of administration. There was tremendous corruption. And it was not a powerful empire. In fact, it was referred to in European textbooks sometimes as the old sick man of Europe. You know, it was falling apart, but it didn't quite collapse. You know, it wasn't in good shape, the Ottoman Empire, in terms of being a strong empire. And they had their own issues as World War I broke out, because they backed the wrong horse, as it turns out. Okay? The Ottoman Empire allied themselves with the so-called Central Powers, Germany, Austria-Hungary, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was, you know, the opposite side of let's say, France and England and ultimately the United States in World War I. They joined that side. They had problems at home, the so-called Armenian Genocide of 1915, where the Turks massacred 1.5 million Armenians in what they referred to as the Armenian Holocaust. If you go in the old city of Yerushalayim, if you walk through Shar Yafo and you go to the coastal that way, you know, through the, you know, the Rehov Arachaim, the Jewish quarter, so you're a little bit in the Armenian quarter first, you can still see, because it was 1915, so a couple years ago they had the 100th, they marked the 100th anniversary of the Armenian genocide, and you know, they had stickers and so on the wall and posts, you can still see them, you know, and their maps of the Armenian genocide, you can still see it, though many of you are nodding, so you've seen it. That was the Armenian genocide perpetrated by the Turks, the Ottoman Empire in 1915. But in any event, the Ottoman Empire was part of the side in World War I that ultimately lost. And that's going to be very important, because what happens when you lose, ordinarily, is it's expected that you lose whatever territory you were previously in ownership of. And it becomes now the decision of the victors as to how to divide up that territory. The British and the French, which were on the other side, anticipated a victory over the Ottoman Empire, and they began to prepare for it even before the war. And the question is, with whom are they going to deal in the Middle East? Well, they had to deal certainly with Arabs. There was an Arab population. The Arab population was officially under the Ottoman Empire, but they weren't Turks. They were just under the Ottoman Empire. And there was a correspondence known as the McMahon-Hussein correspondence, Lieutenant Colonel Sir Henry McMahon, the British High Commissioner of Egypt, and Hussein bin Ali, who was the Sharif of Mecca. That was his title. And basically, this Hussein Sharif had nationalistic desires, and he wanted to create an independent Arab nation. And he met with this guy McMahon, and they corresponded back and forth. You can read, some of the correspondences, and basically wanted the Arabs to have a national homeland. And of course, his position would be that he'd be in charge of it, an independent Arab nation, which would be supported by the British. And the British agreed if the Arabs of the Middle East would assist in fighting against the Turks, against the Ottoman Empire in World War I, their empire. So we have a little bit of a tit-for-tat kind of arrangement, a good political arrangement. You'll get your people to fight on our side and overthrow the Ottoman Turks in World War I. Then after the war is over, we'll help you out and we'll set up a national state. That was the McMahon-Hussein correspondence. There was an Arab revolt against the Turks, June 1916 to September 1918. The time the British general in chief was Allenby. We've heard of Allenby, the Rehov Allenbys, and so on and so forth. In Eretz Yisrael, the Allenby Bridge we know about, etc. He was the lead general. The person who was in charge, a British who was in charge of, some of the soldiers of the Arab, worked with this Hussein, was a gentleman by the name of T.E. Lawrence, who's known as Lawrence of Arabia. That's the famous Lawrence of Arabia. You can guess where he was from. He was. So they were victorious over the Turks as the Ottoman Empire fell. And cities like Damascus and Amman and so on were expecting that they would become now part of some sort of independent Arab state, which would be under the direction of this Hussein. But at the same time as these McMahon-Hussein correspondence took place, there was something called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Okay, Britain and France and Russia was involved in well in May 1916, and I believe his name was Mark Sykes and Francois Picot basically decided that they're going to win World War I, so how are we going to divide up this area? And they didn't necessarily concern themselves with an Arab state. And the idea was that the British would receive what was then called Palestine, that we call Eretz Yisrael, what's now called Jordan and part of what's now called Iraq, whereas France would get parts of southeast Turkey, what's now called Syria, and what's now called Lebanon. That was the deal. And the Arabs, when they heard about this, viewed this, not incorrectly, as a double cross. Right? You're having these private agreements about how you, the European powers, are going to divvy up the land. What happened to our interests? Well, the Jews, meanwhile, who weren't part of either of these operations and either of these negotiations, the Jews were slowly, as I said before, returning to Eretz Yisrael. And they were building up the land. Okay, in the 1850s, Sir Moses Montefiore, we know about the windmill, but he didn't only build a windmill. He did a lot to encourage the economy in Eretz Yisrael. There are a number of neighborhoods in Yerushalayim which have Moshe in it. His name was Moshe, Moses Montefiore. So we have Zichron Moshe and Kiryat Moshe. Now the world was named for him because he helped establish it. He purchased orange groves in Tel Aviv. There was no Tel Aviv, but in that area, as far back as 1855. And this is, he built up together with others, areas that now became, soon became agricultural centers for Eretz Yisrael. This was, of course, besides, there was, I want to stress, there was a yeshuv, we spoke about that in past years, there was a yeshuv in Yerushalayim, there was an old yeshuv, both Sfaradim and Ashkenazim, but it wasn't, you know, it was basically living off of foreign funds. Okay, you had the Jews collected for the Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, again, some of us may remember Stucker boxes of Meir Balanes, okay, for Kolel Poland and Kolel this and Kolel that. Kolel didn't mean necessarily people sitting and learning. It meant for the people who, you know, the Jews of Poland. So if you emigrated, when you moved to Eretz Yisrael from Poland, so the Polish Jews supported, and that was called Kolel Poland, okay, and then Kolel Ungar, and then, you know, this in Yerushalayim, near Meir Shon, the Bote Ungar, I don't know what I'm talking about, right? You see, again, that's, it was set up at that time. So this was, again, to support this. It was a different, was not an economically independent, but it was a presence of Jews. And again, among the Zionists in the 1880s, late 1880s, early 1880s, to 1903, you had the Jews moving to Eretz Yisrael, the so-called Chibat Zion movement. Baron Maurice Hirsch, Baron Hirsch, that's the big shul in Memphis, right? The Baron Hirsch Synagogue. There's a Rehov, Baron Hirsch, and Kiryat Moshe. Okay, Baron Hirsch, who's actually more interested in Jewish refugees and established with his money, you know, organization and stuff for refugees for Jews, but he also sent money to Eretz Yisrael. He had a Jewish colonization organization or association, JCA, Jewish Colonization Association, which took care of refugees, and even after he died in the 1890s, so that contributed money to establishing Jewish settlements. More important, I guess, was Baron, a different Baron, Benjamin Edmund James de Rothschild, the famous Baron Rothschild, who purchased land and settled land. He got people to move there. And communities like Metula and Rosh Pinah in the north, right? Again, those who've been there, traveled, are familiar with these places, Rosh Pinah in the north, Zichron Yaakov, Rishon LeZion, okay? And then the wine manufacturing business and so on is established by Rothschild. In December of 1901, is when they established the so-called Jewish National Fund, the JNF. Again, people my age remember the blue and white tzedakah boxes. We used to connect for JNF, Keren Kayemet L'Yisrael in Hebrew. There is a Rehov, Keren Kayemet L'Yisrael in Shari Chesed, of all places. But that's, they bought land in the Galil, around the Kinneret. They established kibbutzim, moshavim, and so on. So you had Jews who were coming in, building, acquiring land, building up land. The JNF worked with what's called the Palestine Land Development Company, which was established by a gentleman by the name of Arthur Rupin. Rehov Rupin, where the Knesset is and the Israel Museum, you know, that the main street there, Rehov Rupin, named for him. Okay, he set up an overseas fund that was managed by the Keren HaYesod. There's Rehov Keren HaYesod in Yerushalayim. People know where that is as well. You get the idea, right? But the truth is, most of the settlers in Eretz Yisrael at that time were leasing the land, didn't own the land. What ended up happening was more and more Jews were moving in. To get a picture, I'm going to read to you from the 1920 British government's interim report on the civil administration of Palestine. Figured out or estimated by based on a census that in 1920 there were approximately 700,000 people living in what they called Palestine. Of these, 235,000 lived in larger towns, 465,000 in the smaller towns and villages. 4/5, 80% of the population are Muslims, a small proportion of these are Bedouin Arabs. The remainder, although they speak Arabic and are termed Arabic, are largely of mixed race. Some 77,000 of the population are Christians, belong to the Orthodox Church, speak Arabic, the minority from the Latin or the other church, and so on. The Jewish element of the population numbers 76,000. Almost all have entered Palestine during the last 40 years. Again, this is in 1920, according to the official British records. Prior to 1850, there were in the country only a handful of Jews. In the following 30 years, a few hundred came to Palestine. Most of them were animated by religious motives. They came to pray and to die in the Holy Land and to be buried in its soil. But after the persecutions in Russia 40 years ago, the pogroms in Russia in the 1880s, the movement of the Jews to Palestine assumed larger proportions. Jewish agricultural colonies were founded. They developed the culture of oranges and gave importance to the Jaffa orange trade. Well, we don't realize this necessarily, but this is what helped build Eretz Yisrael. They cultivated the vine and manufactured and exported wine. They drained swamps. They planted eucalyptus trees and practiced with modern methods all the processes of agriculture. There are at the present time 64 of these settlements, large and small, with a population of some 15,000. Well, you see from this British report, again, this is the British government's interim report on the civil administration of Palestine in 1920, that the Jews coming in were working actively at building up the land. It wasn't just they came there anymore, you know, to daven in the old city, to be by the coast, on the say Tikkun Chatzos, and ultimately die and be buried on Har HaZeisim, but rather to build up the land. At the same time, in in London, you had Zionists who were trying to work with the British government. Again, this is towards the end of the years, moving towards the end of World War One. Their most notable among them was Chaim Weizmann, who later became the first president of Israel. Chaim Weizmann was recognized as a very persuasive and powerful speaker in several different languages, which is a neat trick. Okay, Sir Ronald Storrs of England described Weizmann as, quote, a brilliant talker with an unrivaled gift for lucid exposition. As a speaker, almost frighteningly convincing, even in English, in Hebrew, and even more so in Russian. Overwhelming. With all that dynamic persuasiveness which Slavs usually devote to love and Jews to business. It wasn't necessarily politically correct, but that's how he spoke at that time. Okay, Nourish trained and concentrated upon the accomplishment of building Zion. Sir Charles Webster, who first met Weizmann at the War Office in England in 1917, considered him the greatest statement of his time. With unerring skill, wrote Webster, he adapted his argument to the special circumstance of each statesman. The politician, in other words. To the British and Americans, he could use biblical language and awake a deep emotional undertone. To other nationalities, he more often talked in terms of interest. Mr. Lloyd George, we'll get to him in a second, was told that Palestine was a little mountainous country, not unlike Wales. touch a little bit. With Lord Balfour, the philosophical background of Zionism could be surveyed. For Lord Cecil, the problem was placed in the setting of a new world organization, while to Lord Milner, the extension of imperial power could be vividly portrayed. In other words, depending on who he was talking to, Weizmann knew how to present things to get support. And get support he did. David Lloyd George was an important British politician. There is a Rehov Lloyd George. There was another Emek Rephaim area. There's a Rehov Lloyd George off of Rehov Emek Rephaim. Okay, so it was against this, with people like Weizmann who were able to work with the British to create an allegiance and a support for a Zionist state, for a Jewish state. And the idea again, as World War I is raging, okay, that Jewish support, especially in countries where, for example, in the Middle East, when you had Jews who could spy on Ottoman and Turk, there's an organization called Neely. When you hear Neely is Rosh Yitzchak, is an acronym. Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker. Okay, Netzach Yisrael, that was a spy, among other things, they spied on Turkish and Ottoman. So anyway, ultimately, the significant turning point was, in terms of the British attitude towards the Jewish state, was, of course, the famous Balfour Declaration, November 2nd, 1917. I'll read it to you. It was a letter written by Arthur James Balfour. Okay, dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet. Quote, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. So that is the famous Balfour Declaration. Now that was in, as I say, November 2nd, 1917. With the conclusion of World War One, the end of World War One, Israel and the rest of what we today call the Middle East, that whole mass of territory, came under the temporary rulership of what was called the Occupied Enemy Territory Administration, OETA, which was a joint British and French military administration. The League of Nations, which was the UN of its time, as you know, the United States never joined it, the League of Nations set up what's called a mandate to set up the legal status for the territories transferred from the centrality or from the control of one power to another after World War One. It was basically a treaty, sort of like a constitution guaranteeing people's rights. Okay, and the idea of a mandate was that, well, one second, we can't really allow these quote-unquote primitive folks to run their own country just yet. We have to show them how it is done. Okay, I'm reading now, the mandate was established by Article 22 of the Covenant of the League of Nations, drafted by, of course, the people who make the terms are always the winners in the war, right? I mean, the Nuremberg trials would not have taken place if the United States had lost the war, and Truman would have brought on trial for bombing Japan, right? But anyway, it's always the winners who set things up. The article referred to territories which, after the war, were no longer ruled by their previous sovereign, but the peoples were not considered, the indigenous people were not considered, quote, able to stand by themselves under the strenuous conditions of the modern world. These are not people who can set up a country themselves. And therefore, the article called for their training to be, quote, entrusted to the advanced nations who, by reason of their resources, their experience, or their geographical position, can best undertake this responsibility. The idea of the mandate, the idea of a mandate was to train, you know, to be there for X number of years and to train the people who are there as to how to run a government. A little bit, you know, arrogant, but that was basically the basic idea. Now, these articles were part of the Treaty of Versailles, etc. Okay. Now, this Faisal, who was I mentioned before, right, the Arab, one of the leaders of the Arab population, the Muslim population, understood, he was not a fool, he understood that Jews are interested in coming back, and therefore there were, something lesser known, conversations between Faisal and Weizmann. Okay? I'll read from here. The Faisal-Weizmann agreement on January 3rd, 1919, basically this Amir Faisal, okay, he's actually the son of the first one I mentioned before, and Chaim Weizmann, basically declared the following. In effect, they said, we are the two major branches of the Semitic family. We're cousins, right? I mean, in a moment of, you know, of peace, so to speak, okay? And basically, the agreement, as quoted in the London Times, said as follows. This is the 12th of December, 1918, right before they signed the document. The two main branches of the Semitic family, Arabs and Jews, understand one another. And I hope that as a result of the interchange of ideas at the peace conference, which will be guided by ideals of self-determination and nationality, each nation will make definite progress towards the realization of its aspirations. Arabs are not jealous of Zionist Jews and intend to give them fair play. And the Zionist Jews have assured the nationalist Arabs of their intention to see that they too have their fair play in their respective areas. Turkish intrigue in Palestine has raised jealousy between the Jewish colonists and the local peasants, but the mutual understanding of the aims of Arabs and Jews will at once clear away the last trace of this former bitterness, which indeed had already practically disappeared before the war by the work of the Arab Secret Revolutionary Committee, which in Syria and elsewhere laid the foundation of Arab military success of the past 2 years. Well, that was optimistic. But there was this sense that it was possible. And this is known as the Faisal-Weizmann Agreement, signed on January 3rd, 1919. It was never ratified because Faisal was ultimately in Syria, was ultimately kicked out of his position and was no longer in position to do what he wanted to do. There were, in 1920, riots known as the Nebi Musa riots. Musa is Arabic for Moshe Rabbeinu. Nebi is Navi. Okay. Apparently, there is a Muslim practice that they have this some sort of a holiday or festival in March. They march from Jerusalem to where they believe that Moshe was buried. The Torah tells us we don't know where Moshe was buried, but okay, in their tradition they figured it out. So they believe that, and they march from there. It's called the Nebi Musa celebration, Nebi Musa festival. It's actually on Easter, as things worked out. And this occasion was used as a riot, as an excuse, really, for a riot to protest what was going on, the possible implementation of the Balfour Declaration. But unlike this Hussein, who wanted to work it out with Weizmann, there were radicals who were not interested in working anything out and wanted nothing to do with any Jews coming into the land. And so there were riots, okay, in a number of different communities, and most specifically in Yerushalayim. The crowd were rioting, screamed independence, independence, Palestine is our land, the Jews are our dogs, and people who are Palestinian police joined in the violence, and they ransacked the Jewish quarter of Yerushalayim. The Toras Chaim Yeshiva was raided, Sifrei Torah were taken out and thrown into the street and desecrated and so on. The Yeshiva building was set on fire, and in 3 hours, 160 Jews were injured. Khalil al-Sakakani, who was an Arab, wrote as follows. A riot broke out. The people began to run about and stones were thrown at the Jews. Shops were closed and there were screams. I saw a Zionist soldier covered in dust and blood. Afterwards, I saw one Hebronite approach a Jewish shoeshine boy who hid behind the sack in one of the wall's corners next to the Jaffa gate, and he took his box and beat him over the head. The boy screamed and began to run, his head bleeding, and the Hebronite left him and returned to the procession. The riot reached its zenith. All shouted, quote, "Muhammad's religion was born with the sword." I immediately walked to the nearby municipal garden. My soul is nauseated and depressed by the madness of humankind. That was this Arab's rejection to these riots. But they didn't stop just that day. It grew worse. The old city was sealed off. Okay, the old city community had no training or weapons. Vladimir Jabotinsky, had trained men, but because of the way things were, his men were stuck outside the city. They couldn't get in. And again, the old city's Jewish community, many people were injured. 5 Jews, 4 Arabs died in the riots. 216 Jews were injured, 18 critically, 23 Arabs, 1 critically. About 300 Jews were evacuated from the old city. Now, Chaim Weizmann and others accused the British of assisting in this riot. And it's not clear, okay? It's not clear. In fact, someone who made that accusation in the British Army was dismissed from his position. But they noted, the Zionist Commission noted, that before the riots, and this is the way it always is, and it's true down to this day, these so-called spontaneous riots, right? These so-called, peaceful demonstrations and so on and so forth, we see it today. And this is what happened. The Zionist Commission noted in protesting to the British that before the riots, Arab milkmen started to demand that their customers in Mea Shearim pay them on the spot, explained they would no longer be serving the Jewish neighborhood. Christian storekeepers marked their shops in advance with the sign of the cross so that they would not be mistakenly looted. In other words, there was seemed to be hints in advance that something was coming. And there was suggestion that, again, the British colluded. Again, it was not really proved. But in any event, this is, this gives you the picture. And these were the riots of the Nebi Musa riot. Menachem Usishkin is a Rechov Usishkin. Okay, Menachem Usishkin, who was a Zionist leader, so spoke to a British leader who said to him, "I regret, I'm so sorry about the events that took place over the last few days." He says, "You're talking about the pogrom, you mean?" So now, pogrom means it was organized by the government, right? "You're talking about the pogrom?" He said, "No, I wouldn't call it a pogrom." He says, "I'm an expert at pogroms. That was a pogrom." And that's how the Jews continued to refer to it, implying, as I said before, that it was, at least to some extent, government-sponsored and government-run. Meanwhile, however, the riots died down, and as always the case, life goes on, and the Jews continued to do what they were supposed to. Again, it was martial law for a time, but the idea was that it was time to continue. And there were inquiries and reports, and I have statistics here, which I'm not going to read as an account of time. There was, for a while, Jewish immigration temporarily halted. But one of the results of this situation was that the Palestinian Jews, the Jews of Israel, set up defense unit, which later came to be known as the Haganah. Right? That was, the result of this. Okay. In any event, in terms of the politics, politics went on. And again, in April of 1920, a few weeks later, you had the famous conference in San Remo, Italy, the San Remo Conference. Now, the San Remo Conference, outgrowth of the Paris Peace Conference, basically divided the area of what we now call the Middle East, which has been part of the Ottoman Empire, into 3 parts: Palestine, Syria, and Mesopotamia. And the question, who exactly would rule over what? Okay. Again, you had this Sharif al-Hussein and his family who were declared the kings or the leaders of that area, but it wasn't so clear that that was going to happen when the negotiations stopped. At the Paris Peace Conference, the Arabs sued for independence, the World Zionist Organization asked for a British mandate. Okay, the San Remo Conference was attended by British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, the French Prime Minister, and representatives from other countries as well. And there were several conclusions to this San Remo Conference. One was that the British got the mandate in Palestine. The French got Syria and Lebanon, and so on. And, of course, the Jews called for, and the British, at least officially, did recognize or make official the Balfour Declaration. It was agreed at the San Remo Resolution, I read, A, to accept the terms of the mandate's article in Palestine and so on. Okay. At the same time, the mandate article should be that the parties note that Syria shall be according to this, Mesopotamia according to that, but ultimately that the Jewish home, that the mandatory will be responsible for putting into effect the declaration originally made on 2nd November 1917 by the British government and adopted by the other Allied powers in favor of the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, it being clearly understood that nothing will be done which may prejudice in the civil and religious rights of others, and so on and so forth. So now you had not just the Balfour Declaration, a letter from an official British representative to a Jewish leader, but you now had ratified as part of the peace treaty process that's ended World War I, and this San Remo conference, you now had official recognition of a Jewish homeland to be supported in the land of Israel. The London Times, April 26, 1920. The title of the article, the headline article, Zionist Rejoicing, British Mandate for Palestine Welcomed. News of the conferment of the mandate of Palestine on Great Britain has created a great impression on Zionist and Jewish circles. A prominent Zionist has given the following views to a representative of the London Jewish Correspondence Bureau. The news that Great Britain is to have the mandate for Palestine and the decision to incorporate the Balfour Declaration in the Treaty of Peace with Turkey will be received with intense gratification by Jews in all countries. Means that at last, after 20 centuries, the Jews will begin the work of reestablishing their ancient homeland under a stable and civilized government. The wandering Jews will at last have a home. The Jews have always desired to be under British trusteeship, realizing that the British colonizing methods are based upon the notion of giving free scope to the peoples under their protection. The Zionist leaders at San Remo, who have been the spokesmen of the Jewish claims of Dr. Weizmann and Mr. Sokolow, they have been greatly assisted by the support of Mr. Herbert Samuel in this country and Mr. Justice Brandeis, Louis Brandeis, Chief Justice here in the United States of America. Another factor which undoubtedly contributed to the granting of the Zionist demands is their great moderation. The practical consequence of the decision at San Remo will be that Jewish energy and capital will begin to flow towards Palestine to be devoted to the development of the country and to the benefit of all its inhabitants. The event will be celebrated by all Jewish centers with great joy, and the date, April 24th, 1920, will perhaps become a Jewish national holiday, the opposite of Tisha B'Av. A Zionist Congress and possibly a pan-Jewish Congress will have to be convened at an early date to concentrate Jewish effort on the restoration of Palestine. This was the San Remo Conference, and you can imagine the optimism and the feeling that Jewish people had. No less a person than the great Gaon HaGadol, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, author of the Meshech Chochma and the Chumash, the Or Sameach and the Rambam, one of the Gedolei Torah, one of the Gedolei Hachronim, wrote, it's in print, and not the Meshech Chochma or Or Sameach, in another essay, he wrote that with this, the concern that the Gemara says that we're not permitted to take over Eretz Yisrael by force, a difficult Gemara in Ksubas Daf Kuf Yud Aleph, the so-called Shalosh Shvuos Oats, based on Psukim and Shir Hashirim, now's not the time, but basically there was a tradition, a long-standing Jewish tradition going back to the Gemara, that the Jews are prohibited from taking over the country by force. The Or Sameach wrote at that point, Rav Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, that now that it's been given to us by international agreement, the San Remo Conference as part of the Paris Peace Conference and so on, and this resolution of World War II, that no longer is in effect. The Shal Shavuos and that concern is no longer in effect. And again, you can imagine, as I said before, the euphoria and the rejoicing of the Jewish people at that time. From that period of high hopes, of course, not everything worked out as planned. There continued to be concern on the part of the Arabs as to what was going to happen with them. Okay, the British appointed a Jew to be the High Commissioner. The Jew's name was Herbert Samuel. He was not an observant Jew, although he sometimes came to shul. Those who have been to the relatively newly reconstituted Churva Synagogue, right, so they have a little bit about the history, so that Herbert Samuel came and he got an aliyah there and everything. So he wasn't an observant Jew, but Herbert Samuel had the distinction of being the first Jew to have political power in Eretz Yisrael since the Churban, 2,000 years. He was a Jew, again, not a firm Jew, but he was a Jew. His appointment was not particularly, did not particularly thrill the Muslim or even the Christian community. The Muslim Christian Association sent a telegram to the British government to Herbert Samuel, regarded as a Zionist leader, and his appointment as the first step in formulating a Zionist national home in the midst of Arab peoples, contrary to their wishes. Inhabitants cannot recognize him, and Muslim Christian society cannot accept responsibility for riots or other disturbances of peace. Don't blame us when things get violent. That's basically what they were saying. Now, it's interesting because, as some put it, Herbert Samuel was remembered well, neither by most of the Zionists, because they felt they didn't do enough, because he had to walk. Don't judge somebody until you're doing his place, but he had to walk a tightrope, okay, because, you know, he officially is working for Britain, and he didn't want to make it overtly Jewish. On the other hand, he was Jewish, so the Arabs didn't like him, we saw, and many of the Arabs viewed him as the personification of an alliance between the Zionists and British imperialism. Okay, and the Jews felt they didn't do enough for the Jews. So that's a problem that Herbert Samuel had in terms of his particular legacy. Now, in March of 1921, he made a move which, you know, really would have long-standing negative impact on the Jewish people. It's not clear that whether he made this move or not, it wouldn't happen anyway. But he did appoint a very violently anti-Semitic Arab as the so-called Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a man by the name of Haj Amin al-Husseini, who many of you have heard. Okay, he was a strong Arab nationalist. He was so-called Mufti of Jerusalem, and he was appointed by Herbert Samuel to... Now, he had had a hand in those riots that I spoke about earlier, the Nebi Musa riots. In fact, he had been arrested, okay, and skipped the country. But now he and other people, also Jabotinsky, other people, they had a, they've been given a pardon or a clemency and so on. Anyway, now he was elevated to a very, very strong position. A former leader of the riots against the Jews was now in a position of mufti. The mufti used to be appointed by the Sultan of Turkey, the Ottoman Empire. Now there's no more Ottoman Empire, so it was the British representative appointed him. He was a strong Arab nationalist and a very strong anti-Zionist, and we assume anti-Semite as well. And as I say, he is to be responsible, with many others, for a lot of difficulties that the Jews had. A lot of the difficulty revolved around, and things don't change, the Kosel Maravi and the Temple Mount. Okay, this is 100 years ago, but it's basically the same thing. Haram al-Sharif was what did I pronounce it correctly? Haram al-Sharif is what the Muslims refer to the said Temple Mount as. And Haj al-Husseini distributed leaflets. This is later in the 1920s, and I'm skipping around a little bit because of time, but basically accusing the Jews of wanting to take over the Temple Mount and destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Well, there's nothing like inflaming intentions. I mean, in our lifetime, we've seen this. You know, every time there's a new tunnel, every time there's any kind of digging, any time there's any kind of anything, there's an immediate response. Oh, the Jews are trying to take over the... Ein Chodesh Tachas HaShemesh. This is not a new situation. We'll get back to Haj Amin al-Husseini in a moment. Jewish immigration through the 1920s continued, and it continued at a strong pace. So, just to read you some statistics, get a picture of the Jewish community, okay? From 1920 to 1923, Jewish immigration was running at an annual rate of about 8,000. In 1924, 13,000. 1925, 33,000. Okay, so you had a tremendous impact, influx of Jews, okay, during these years. There were a number of different factors. Again, this is not the issue, this is in the 1920s, this is before the rise of the Nazis. Okay, but there were problems for the Jews in Poland, okay, there was problems in Russia the Jews were moving away from, and it was at that time that the United States restricted immigration. Okay, and the United States, I mean, we know in the 1920s, restricted, I mean, not just Jews, but in general. So these things contributed to Jews coming to Eretz Yisrael. Interestingly enough, at this point, it was not there was not any open violence. There was tension brewing beneath the lid, so to speak. It was in 1925 when Balfour himself was 77. He made his first and only visit. He either ignored or didn't notice the Arab display of public mourning. He passed through silent streets in the old city of Yerushalayim and assumed that friendly salutations addressed to his companion were addressed to him as well. You know, so hear no evil, see no evil. But things were brewing. And as the year 1929, which was really a turning point in the British mandate period, and a very sad turning point for Jews, arrived is when Haji Amin al-Husseini got busy. Okay, began to distribute, I say, this reopen this claim that the Jews are going to take over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and he set up what's called a Muslim Supreme Council. Quote, having realized by bitter experience the unlimited greedy aspirations of the Jews in this respect, Muslims believe that the Jews aim to take possession of the mosque of Al-Aqsa gradually on the pretense that it is a temple. And therefore it was advised to the Jews, stop this hostile propaganda, which will naturally engender a parallel action in the whole Muslim world, the responsibility for which will rest with the Jews. Okay, in October of 1928, he organized new construction right next to the wall. Okay, right next to the coast of Maravi. Again, they controlled the walk, controlled the area. Mules were driven through the area where Jews were davening. A few Jews were there, often dropping their waste, their excrement over there. Wastewater was thrown onto the Jews. And he set up a muzain, that's what the Arabs call the people of prayer, right over there. And I don't exactly know how the Zmanei Tefillah match ours, but somehow they always seemed to be having noise from the muzain exact moment when the Jews were trying to daven. Okay, so there was a certain amount of provocations. The Jews protested with the British, and the Zionists began making demands for their control over the wall. Okay, Ben-Gurion himself, who then was active in the Jewish agency, said that we have to redeem it. Jabotinsky was always more violent, of course, and he said we have to take it by force, and all kinds of different moves on the part of the Jews. There was a Jewish professor called Joseph Klausner, who set up what he called the Pro-Wailing Wall Committee, and he called the following. He called the following. During the 9 days, this time of year, 1929, Jews and national Jews in all part of the world, wake up and unite. Do not keep silent or rest in peace until the entire war has been restored to us. Form yourselves into pro-Wailing Wall societies. Hold meetings of protest. Go and demonstrate before the British consuls in all countries on behalf of the wall. Submit protest memorials to them. Explain to the Jewish mass and to the young generation what has been and what is the Kosel to Israel in the past and the present. Explain to the righteous and the pious among the nations of the world what is the national insult which we have suffered at the hands of the British officials without justice or right. Move heaven and earth at the unspeakable and unprecedented injustice and oppression which tends to rob a live nation of the last of its relics and its poor man's land. Those of us here will not rest until that relic which has always been ours, which has been sealed with the blood of scores of thousands of our children through 2 millennia, and which has absorbed the tears of Israel for 2,000 years, has been restored to us. Come to our help, cooperating in this just struggle for the wall, and the triumph is sure to come. Written Yerushalayim, the 9 days, 5, 6, 8, 9, 1929, the Pro-Wailing Wall Committee. What happened, or what kind of led to this, was that in September of 1928, on Yom Kippur, the Jews set up a mechitza at the wall. The Jews were not permitted to do anything physical. They were allowed to come to the Kotel HaMaravi by the Arab authorities to pray, and that's it. They weren't allowed to bring benches and chairs to sit on, and so on. Yom Kippur, Kol Nidre night, 1928, they brought a mechitza. And the Muslim officials immediately complained to the British, a gentleman by the name of Edward Keith Roche was approached, and he said, well, you can keep it up, and he wanted immediately to take it down, and somebody there persuaded him, said the Jews are praying now, wait till after the prayers, and he said okay, they left it up, and he said it's got to be gone by tomorrow morning. This is kind of what a little bit precipitated this, and the Arabs viewed this, building a mechitza, oh, they're putting up mechitza, they're going to bring chairs and benches. Next thing you know, they're going to take over the whole area. And this is how he inflamed the passions of many of his Arab and Muslim men. On Tisha B'Av of 1929, shortly after the Klausner letter, on Tisha B'Av of 1929, several hundred Jewish more right-wing, or not religiously right-wing, I'm talking about, but Jabotinsky followers and so on, came to the Kotel HaMaravi, to daven, or whatever they were doing there. They were saying kinnis, whatever they were doing. But they also had what was then called the Zionist flag, and they sang the HaTikva. And it was a moment of claim that on this day of Tisha B'Av, in 1929, we're going to show our control, at least, of this last vestige of our Beis HaMikdash. Well, a few days later, on Friday, of that year. This was a Tisha B'Av, was the next day rather. Tisha B'Av was a Thursday that year, August 15. Friday. Friday is the Muslim Sabbath. And very often there are radical speeches given in the mosque and so on by those who are radical, not by everybody. Friday, August 16th, a demonstration was organized by the Supreme Muslim Council and so on under Haji Amin Husseini, and it brought him down to the Western Wall where they burned Sidurim and they ruined the certain things that people had. They took, well, the kvitlach, you know, the papers that people stick into the wall with various tefillahs, they emptied them all out and burnt them and so on. And the demonstrations then, they beat up the Jewish shamus who was on duty at that point, who was there. And the demonstrations spread to elsewhere in Yerushalayim. And the same way, ironically enough, the same way this Klausner sent a letter to the Jews, summoning them to stand up for the Kosel, so articles were circulated among the Muslims, among the Arabs, signed by the Committee of the Holy Warriors of Palestine, saying that the Jews are violating the honor of Islam, and declared, quote, hearts are in tumult because of these barbaric deeds, and the people began to break out in shouts of war, jihad, rebellion. O Arab nation, the eyes of your brothers in Palestine are upon you, and they awaken your religious feelings and national zealotry to rise up against the enemy who violated the honor of Islam and raped the women and murdered widows and babies, etc. So we see this conflict brewing. About a week later, Friday, August 23rd, 1929, is already the week after Tisha B'Av, almost Tu B'Av, a crowd of 700 Arabs gathered at the city's Tachana Merkazit, the central bus station. We'll get to that in a second, because they went to Hebron. But this was, there were riots in Yerushalayim, okay, and the, we'll speak about Hebron momentarily, riots in Yerushalayim. There were attacks, but worse than Yerushalayim in 1929 was the riots in Hebron. Again, we'll have to cut a little bit because of time. But just to give you an idea, there was a British officer, Raymond Cafferata, who was on duty in Hebron. And when he heard reports of Jews coming from Yerushalayim, and other Jews, Arabs coming to Hebron, he wanted to get more soldiers and so on, and backup. The backup never came, and there were attacks on homes where Jews resided. Cafferata appeared on the scene. He gave orders to his policemen to fire on the crowd and break it up, but according to one survivor by the name of Aaron Reuven Bernzweig, quote, right after 8 o'clock in the morning, we heard screams. Arabs had begun breaking into Jewish homes. The screams pierced the heart of the heavens. We didn't know what to do. They were going from door to door, slaughtering everyone who was inside. The screams and the moans were terrible. People were crying, help, help, what can we do? Now, soon after news of the first victims had spread, about 40 people came to the home of Rabbi Lezer Don Slonim, who was the son of one of the Rabbanim in Hebron, who himself was a member of the city council, who had very good relations both with the British and with the Arabs. And about 40 people came to his house because they figured there will be no harm will come to him. Well, when the mob approached, and here's what's interesting, because Jews had been living in Hebron for a long time. They'd been a Sephardi community there for many, many years. And that's not who the Arabs were, at least at that point, protesting against, because they had already lived there. They didn't like the immigrants, the Ashkenazi immigrants. And so according to this report, they offered to spare the Sephardi community if he would hand over the Ashkenazi yeshiva students. He refused, saying we're all one people. And for that refusal, he was shot dead, along with his wife and his four-year-old son. From the four-fifths of the victims ultimately in Hebron were Ashkenazi Jews, okay? A gentleman by the name of Gershon Ben Sion, the Beis Hadassah, those who have been to Hebron will call Beis Hadassah, the Beis Hadassah clinic pharmacist, a cripple who had served both Jews and Arabs for 40 years, was killed together with his family. His daughter was raped and then murdered, and his wife's hands were cut off. So there was tremendous brutality. And this was also corroborated by the British. That is not to say that there weren't some Arabs, and you have to make the point, okay, who saved Jews, who were friendly with Jews, who had been on friendly terms with them, who saved them, protected them from the mob. Yaakov Yosef Slonim, who was Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Hebron, stated that his life was saved. Okay, when the mob was outside, killed the Jews and so on and so forth, he was saved by a friendly Arab. The same person I quoted before, Aaron Reuven Bernzweig, related that an Arab by the name of Haj Issa El Kurdier saved a group of 33 Jews, and he insisted that they hide in his cellar. These Jews waited in the cellar for the trouble to pass, and afraid that the murderers outside they would hear their children were crying and so on and so forth. But from the cellar, this is the report, they heard cried of from the outside from the mob, "Today is a day that is holy to Muhammad. Anyone who is not a Jew, who does not kill a Jew, is a sinner." However, several Arab women from his family stood guard outside, repeatedly challenging the mob, and who claimed that they were sheltering Jews, and their answer was, "No, we already killed our Jews." And they bought it. A woman by the name of Yona Molchadsky gave birth while taking refuge in an Arab basement. And according to Malka Slonim, an aged Arab called Abu Shaker defended them. And here's her testimony. "We sat silently in the sealed house. Abu Shaker reported what was happening. The rioters had arrived. We heard them growling cries of murder. We also heard the voice of Abu Shaker, 'Get out of here. You won't enter here. You will not enter my home.' They pushed him. He was an old man, maybe 75, but he had a strong body. He struggled. He sat in front of the entrance to his home and cried out, 'Only over my dead body will you pass through, over my corpse.' One rider took a knife over Abu Shaker and yelled, 'I will kill you, you traitor.' The knife struck him and his leg was cut and his blood was spilt. But he did not emit any groans of pain. He did not shout, and he said, 'Go and cut what you want. I'm not moving.' The riders stopped, consulted with each other. There was a moment of silence, and we heard them leave." So these were either were Arabs, like we found in the Holocaust of people who saved Jews. There were Arabs. But again, the brutality, the destruction of the Hebron Yeshiva, and we've seen pictures of people whose arms and limbs were cut off and so on. In total, 67 Jews and 9 Arabs were killed. Of the Jews, 59 during the riot, 8 died later and so on. And there was a commission that followed this. And by the way, it was not limited, I must stress, to Yerushalayim and to Hebron. Those are the places that I mentioned. I have here a list, and no time to read, of what happened in different communities. Haifa, there were riots. Yafo, there were riots. And this now became, as I say, this was a turning point, because as the British report, which followed, made clear, this isn't working. Okay, the commission that looked into it afterwards was something called the Shaw Commission. Okay, and the Shaw Commission, and I have it in quotes in books, but I'm not going to read it inside now to save some time, faulted Jews for this as well. You know, they were provoking and this and that, and everything has, you know, there's politics and everything has two sides. And it became pretty clear that this situation is not working. In the mid-1930s, there was an Arab uprising, which really wasn't targeted per se at the Jews. It was really against the Jews and the British. And that resulted in, and I'm skipping a little bit, but that resulted in what was known as the Peel Commission report. Okay, and basically, the Peel Commission stated as follows. What we have to have here is a partition of this land. It has to be a Jewish area and it has to be a Muslim area. That was the first partition plan proposed by the Peel Commission. Chaim Weizmann wasn't happy with it. The Jews were not happy with it. Okay, but and the Arabs rejected it outright. Haji Amin al-Husseini, speaking of the Arabs, rejected it outright. Chaim Weizmann, in November 1936, when he testified before the Peel Commission, spoke about the following. He said, "In Europe," this is in 1936, so we know it was just beginning then, "in Europe there are 6 million Jews, quote, for whom the world is divided into places where they cannot live and places where they cannot enter." And that was an apt description of what was going on. But none, and therefore he and some of the Zionists were willing to accept some form of partition plan and so on. Okay, the Peel Commission found, understandably and correctly, that the drafters of the British Mandate could not have foreseen the advent of massive Jewish immigration. Okay, they could not have foreseen what was going to take place. However, at the same time, quote, "though the Arabs have benefited by the development of the country owing to Jewish immigration," but this had no conciliatory effect. On the contrary, improvement in the economic situation in Palestine has meant a deterioration of the political situation. This is this goes on today. I mean, it's really the same story repeating itself, again and again. For example, the Arab charge that the Jews have obtained through this partition possibility too large a proportion of the good land. The Peel Commission itself said, "You cannot maintain that because much of the land now carrying orange groves was sand and dunes and swamps until the Jews purchased it." Right, the Jews built up the land. There is a pasuk in the Navi Yechezkel. It says, "Vatem Hori Yisrael." The Navi Yechezkel foresees that the land of Israel will produce, the mountain of Israel will produce agriculture. "Atem Hori Yisrael, Anbechem Titenu." sprout your trees and blossom, because that's a sign that the Jews are coming home. And the Gemara says, "Ein lecha keitz migul mizu." This is a sign of the keitz. Well, we know what Mark Twain said in the 1880s when he came to visit what was then called Palestine, and said it was the most desolate, barren, useless country of any place he visited. And we know that when the Jews did build up the land began to sprout and things began to grow. That's Ein lecha keitz migul mizu. But in any event, that the Peel Commission recognized it as well. However, and here's a statement, the summary report: an irrepressible conflict has arisen between two national communities within the narrow bounds of one small country. There is no common ground between them. I just want you to remember what I said before about the Weizmann, Hussein, but the reality set in. I read again. An irrepressible conflict has arisen between two national communities within the narrow bounds of one small country. There is no common ground between them. Their national aspirations are incompatible. The Arabs desire to revive the traditions of the Arab Golden Age. The Jews desire to show what they can achieve when restored to the land which the Jewish nation was born. Neither of the two national ideals permits the combination in the service of a single state. This was the Peel Commission report. It's interesting, the Jewish relation with the British, and that's really what the change a little bit, I just have to read something because it just caught my attention. One of the leading British people, politicians, was a man by the name of Passfield. And after the riots in Hebron, they were described in 1929, so Weizmann, when hearing about it, went to London from Switzerland, where he was, and he received from Passfield a cold reception. In fact, at first Passfield would not even see him, but Weizmann saw Lady Passfield. And according to Weizmann, she said, quote, "I can't understand why the Jews make such a fuss over a few dozen of their people being killed in Palestine. As many people are killed every week in London in traffic accidents, and no one pays any attention." That was her response. The according to Weizmann, the idea that, what the Peel Commission said was correct. Ben-Gurion wrote 20 years later, quote, "Had the partition, the Peel Commission, partition plan, had the partition been carried out, the history of our people would have been different, and 6 million Jews in Europe would not have been killed. Most of them would have been in Israel." And he's right. It's a statement, again, 20 years after the fact. No one could really figure out what was going on. Again, I have here different reaction among Jews to all these different, and that we should show restraint, not show restraint. And again, the 1940s, we have the decade, we'll have to talk about a different time of the different groups of Jews in terms of what they believe and what was the right derech and the Haganah and the Irgun and so on. I'll end with this, because with World War II on the horizon. Late in the evening of August 24th, 1939, Weizmann bade farewell to the delegates of the Zionist Congress at Geneva. As a new European conflict threatened, again, August 24th, 1939, as a new European conflict threatened, the atmosphere of the final session was charged with an acute awareness of impending tragedy. Well, that, no way they could have foreseen. The departures were painful. Weizmann said, in part, "It is with a heavy heart that I take my leave. If, as I hope, we are spared in life and our work continues, who knows? Perhaps a new light will shine upon us from the thick black gloom. There are some things which cannot fail to come to pass, things without which the world cannot be imagined." Deep emotion gripped the Congress. Weizmann embraced his colleagues on the platform. There were tears in many eyes. Few of those people survived the Holocaust. So we speak about, Jewish return to Eretz Yisrael. I stayed away from, whether from Jews, not from Jews, and so on, because it's not the issue. There are places in Eretz Yisrael today which we don't necessarily appreciate the significance of when we see. And I've mentioned many, many times here, giving drushes and shul, that we take Eretz Yisrael for granted. We do. We take it for granted. I include myself. We take Eretz Yisrael for granted. We can go there anytime. We do go there. People go for Yontif. People go for a weekend. People go for this program, and children go, and this and that. This was not, not always the case. And many of us in our own lifetime, it wasn't the case. Rabbi Butler said, he told me that when he grew up in Pittsburgh, that he went to Eretz Yisrael for the year in the 1965. It was such a thing that someone from Pittsburgh was going to Eretz Yisrael. It was on the 6 o'clock news. Okay. A different time. So we take Eretz Yisrael for granted. I remember my mother last Shalom told me that her grandfather, who was the Yelid Yerushalayim from Batei Machzor from the old city of Yerushalayim, had to run away because he was drafted, and all things were drafted into the Turkish army. So he had to, Rav Kook and other Rabbanim suggest that he should run away. He came to America, whatever. Later went back to Eretz Yisrael. So anyway, so he lived in America, and she said when she remembers a little girl, because during the war, when her father was serving as a chaplain overseas, so she lived with her grandparents and lived there. He was a rabbi in Atlantic City in the pre-gambling days. Anyway, she said that she remembers living in the house for a couple of years when a letter, those old blue aerograms, there's a call them, came from Eretz Yisrael. There was such simcha in the house, and if it was Shabbos, when you couldn't open it, he said her grandfather was looking by the window, sittering, what's inside? You know, there was you got a letter from Eretz Yisrael. We take it for granted. We can go anytime. Right now, you can go on Kotel Kam and see this. You can talk to somebody by Skype. And that's wonderful. But do we lose our enthusiasm as a result and our passion for it? So look at the passion of these people. Look what they gave up. Look what they had to live through. Look what that, because, you know, it meant something to them. And sometimes to us, perhaps it doesn't mean something. And to go back with that which I started, and that's what I'll end with. And again, there's a lot more. I told you, just an overwhelming subject, like all. To go back to Tisha B'Av, perhaps this was doomed. We were doomed as a people to have to struggle for Eretz Yisrael because we didn't accept it right away. We sent out the Meraglim and so on, we rebelled and so on. We didn't do what we were supposed to do right away. And therefore, unlike Torah, it did not remain part of our psyche and our national history. However, at least to the same extent, we're now coming to a point, very shortly, the demographic studies reveal that more than half of the Jewish population of the world, or the known Jewish population of the world, will be in Eretz Yisrael. It's a staggering historical fact. More than half. The problems, some of the identical problems that we just read about, different names of people, and maybe different locations, sometimes the same location, the problems are still there. I think it behooves us on Tisha B'Av to at least contemplate in our minds, I've said this before, I said this in Shul, whenever I go to Eretz Yisrael, Baruch Hashem for Simchas and relative, whatever else, it's just like everybody else, but I always think to myself at one point or another as we're walking around, should I be living here? Did I make a mistake by not moving here and so on? And we have all kinds of terutzim and good ones, and I'm not, this is not going to now the halakhic issues of whether there's a mitzvah today or not. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about in terms of attitude, in terms of mindset. At least if we're not there, to appreciate what we have and to do what we can to support the people who do live there and to make Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael part of what we really, really believe in, to be passionate about it, even if we're not able to go for reasons, whatever the reasons are. There are good reasons. I'm not going to that now, including good halachic reasons, but that's not the issue. The issue is maintaining at least an appreciation, not to take it for granted. One time in our history, we made a big mistake and we didn't accept it. Now it's almost like Eretz Yisrael has been given to us again. A second time. We don't want to make the same mistake. Thank you.